I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me for Slackerwood. Today, I just want to talk to you about Man on a Mission, about the documentary.
Yep, right.
And so, my first question would be, you know Mike and Brady, is that correct?
Yes, exactly. Well, actually, I know them quite well. I've actually known them because we have a mutual network of friends, so I've known them for some years. And when I began to, you know, really plan my, not only just the trip to space, but, you know, even before I went to space and began to plan my, you know, trip over to Russia, I realized, you know, this time I'm going to be spending in Russia is going to be very unusual and has not been well documented. And so Brady and Mike and I sat down and, you know, even before training began, said, you know, this is really footage that would be very sad not to, you know, have a high-quality camera and team out there to capture in real time as it's happening. So Brady and Mike actually made a number of trips overseas. They spent a lot of time in Star City, where I was training. They spent a lot of time at the Baikonur, the launch site. And so they really, in some ways, kind of lived through the experience with me. So it was a phenomenal, even just capturing the footage was kind of a phenomenal experience.
So that was pretty much a first time for you as far as having
Absolutely,
a camera
yeah.
crew and stuff. Also, didn't you make your own film while you were up there?
I did indeed. And I actually shot a small piece that we called Apogee of Fear. It's actually the first ever science fiction movie, ever recorded, fictional movie really, of any kind, recorded in space. Of course, there have been plenty of documentaries and things, or, you know, documentary footage that's been taken in space. But I actually took up a full script and coerced my crewmates to playing parts and actually filmed an entire movie while I was up in orbit. I mean, entire movie is, you know, 5 minutes, but a movie nonetheless.
So is that movie available for viewing now, or is it still in?
Unfortunately, that movie is not at this time available because it includes NASA astronauts and Russian cosmonauts on film. And so what we're trying to do with that is I've been trying to kind of what I'll broadly call share it with NASA, who will then hopefully share it with the world. If you know what I mean. So it's really up to NASA to decide if and or when they might be willing to. Let that be seen publicly.
I know that you went through a lot of training, and that we'll get to see that documentary. What did you enjoy the most with that training, and then what did you find the most grueling?
Well, you know, the best parts of training, you know, are many. You know, everything from the zero-G flights that you do in preparation are phenomenal. You know, learning every single solitary system involved in spaceflight for the Soyuz and the space station. Everything from, you know, life support and navigation and propulsion and electrical and, you know, et cetera, radios. You know, it's really learning all that is just an amazing experience. There were a couple of what I'll call tougher times. You know, I would say that the most difficult and arduous part of the training was the open sea survival training, where they actually toss you in a capsule in the open ocean and have the crew change out of their spacesuits and into sea survival gear before they pop the hatch and jump out. And that actually turns out to be physically, you know, right at the true limit of, you know, a human's capability to perform. And then there's the, what I would call the least fun, fairly regular activity that we would do was the rotating chair.
So your father, Owen Garrett, he'd been up in Skylab back in the 70s. Did he have some advice for you as you were going through the training and getting ready for your flight?
You know, what's interesting is, you know, of course, he worked with me all the way through all of my preparations for flight. So absolutely. I mean, he did things like help make sure that I architected plenty of experiments and time to be at the window looking out at the Earth, because he knew from personal experience that that would be the most impactful and memorable part of the whole experience, which you, of course, were quite right about. But then down to more subtle kind of life on board commentary, like, just before I took my final trip over to Russia, you know, he stopped me and put his hand on my shoulder and said, Richard, you know, just another data point to have in your head is that, you know, if you get sick when you get to orbit, which about 80% of people do, you know, don't let it concern you about the total trip, because it does pass. I mean, it takes, you know, a day or so, but it will pass, and of course, we'll have a great time. So So, you know, so everything from broad planning to subtle fatherly advice, you know, I got through that whole year from my dad.
So what was it like to see him? I mean, he was waiting for you on the arrival, correct?
Yeah, he was one of the last people I saw as I boarded the rocket, and he was one of the first people I saw as I got off the rocket. And so, no, that was great. It was a you know, a really phenomenal way for a father and son to get a chance to share an experience, which, well, in fact, at that time, we were doing it at the same time as the only other father and son pair could do it. Sergei Volkov is the first son of a Russian cosmonaut, like I'm the first son of an American astronaut to fly, and we returned from space together, and both of our parents were there at the landing site.
With his experience and such, you know, I could see where that would kind of fuel your dream as a, you know, when you were very young. But, you know, what else was kind of the incentive for this? I mean, what were your, you know, when you were young, who were your favorite science fiction authors? Did you think when you were a kid that you would, as an adult, you would get to go out into space?
Well, when I was very young, of course, I believed everybody did go to space because my father and all of our neighbors were either astronauts or people involved in putting astronauts in space. It just seemed quite normal to me. And in fact, I wasn't a big reader of science fiction as a young kid because we were living it in a very real way. I was much more of a fantasy reader, and even as a gamer, I was more in the fantasy side than science fiction side. You know, my aspiration for the stars really came from believing that we all could, believing it was normal and a part of the reality that we all could and should have, and then being told as I was a teenager that because I had, for example, bad eyesight, that I would never be able to be a NASA astronaut. And while, you know, at first that was, you might call it crushing, I then quickly turned that disappointment into motivation to say, look, if I can't go with a government-sponsored space program, I have to invent civilian space flight, and thus we did.
You wear many hats, you know, entrepreneur, adventurer, philanthropist. Can you talk about the benefits of space travel, in regards to the science, economy, and such, briefly?
Yeah. Now, what I find interesting about that, too, is that, there are lots of people who are what I call skeptical, especially about human spaceflight, and don't readily see the benefits around them that come from spaceflight. And I have two kind of comments to that. One is, that while on the one hand I understand their skepticism because anything that we spend a large amount of national wealth on needs to be demonstrable as to, what benefit it has for humanity. But one of the interesting things about that exact question is that if you look around your house about the number of things that now use materials, techniques, technology was developed for space, it's stunningly plentiful. You know, in fact, a lot of this new generation of developers of space are building rockets, like my favorite is John Carmack up in Dallas, where the vast majority of stuff that he buys to make his rockets, you can buy on the internet because all the stuff NASA developed is now commonly available through air conditioning and units and, other pieces of home technology that you can literally go buy on the internet, buy all the parts you need to make rockets to go to space. 80% of the parts or 99% of the parts you can buy on the internet. And so that's just how ubiquitous this has become after 50 years. But additionally, though, I think it's important that space, for it to become truly common, that humanity moves off Earth and begins to work and play in space, the costs have to come down far enough that the benefits on a single flight can be measured and be greater than the cost of that same single flight. And that's the target, I think, is now tantalizingly close. You know, I paid tens of millions to go to space, but I did entrepreneurial work that is worth millions in space. And so that means I'm only off by about a factor of 10 before, if my flight was, a tenth the price, I could have made money when I was in space. And the new generation of commercial spaceflight is what will achieve that promise. And when we get there in the next decade or so, that means that we will see what I would call the barnstorming era of space begin, and it's really just right around the corner.
A question I have for you that I also asked Mike, I spoke to him yesterday, because, you know, as a filmmaker, he obviously has a vision for his documentary. But, you know, for you to have be the center of this, my question for you is regards to what do you see as the message to the audience? What do you want folks to take away from this and your story?
What I hope people see through this is probably a couple key messages. You know, one is the fact that this can be done. And even though I've pursued this doggedly and, you know, I've had some other opportunities in my life which have helped lever this, you know, to help me make this happen. The point is that I believe that my journey is a journey that anyone can do. As long as you are passionate about it, are willing to continue to get up and try again, and learn from the mistakes, and then just continue moving forward, so to speak. Another message is just how close this new space race, this barnstorming era, really is. That you know, there's a guy named Tsiolkovsky, a guy named Korolev, the famous Russian rocket designer. You know, he said, you know, the road to space is open, and he said that you know, right after Sputnik was put into space, just says, you know, it can now be done. And I think we're at another pivotal point just like that today, where, you know, the door was cracked open 50 years ago. The door is being flung open now. Some of it will happen within 5 years. You'll see very unmistakable signs that anyone will recognize as an incoming wave within 5 years, and will be upon us within 10.
I believe there's an experiment that took place that I think your father had worked on at Skylab.
Crystal growth.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's just one example of, you know, I'm not a leading space scientist by any remote stretch, but the fact that I could go find valuable work of this type to do in space, in my mind, helps demonstrate that if, you know, you get the price down to the right marker, what the people who are focused on this field for their livelihoods can really do. And so the specifics of protein crystal growth go something like this. For every biological function that exists, in good or bad biological function, there is generally a unique protein involved in that biological function. So there's lots and lots and lots of proteins in the world. So each protein is a very complicated molecule, and a protein's shape, the actual structure of that molecule, is kind of like a little factory. It's a little motor. It does the proteins do things, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Little workhorse. So if you are trying to stop the progression of a disease, one of the common modern therapies to stop the progression of that disease, for example, the way I'm about to describe is how every AIDS drug that currently exists has been developed in this way.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is they find a molecule that will bond with the protein involved in the manifestation of AIDS, and bond strongly with that protein. And that way, that protein can't go off and do its disease function, because it's already got something attached to it.
Right.
Well, one of the best ways to make such a molecule, and the general term for that molecule is called a ligand. Mm-hmm. One of the best ways to make a ligand is if you knew the very precise structure of that protein molecule, if you knew exactly what it looked like, you could design a molecule that would bond with it somewhere and take it offline, so to speak. And one of the best ways to do that is to determine its exact structure is to do something called protein crystallography, which means you grow a crystal of the protein, which puts them all, the protein molecules all lined up tidy and neat. You put it in an X-ray diffraction device, and you take a picture of it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as it turns out, if you try to grow these crystals of proteins here on the Earth, the molecules are so big and complicated that they don't crystallize very easily. You have to let them crystallize over weeks, if not months, to even grow a tiny little crystal. And when you grow those crystals here on the Earth, there's little convection currents that get caused by exothermic or endothermic properties of going from liquid to solid, and that disturbs the growth of the crystal. And so you don't get very good crystals here on the Earth. But if you grow those crystals in space, you get very big, very pure crystals. You can bring them back down to the Earth, image those, get very high-resolution pictures, and cut years and millions of dollars off the development of drugs.
That's just amazing. And that right there is what you now understand what you're saying earlier about, you know, going up and spending as much as you do to be there, but then the research is worth millions, you know, the work that's being done there in that environment. So
Right. And there's another company here in town called AstroTech that is doing vaccine development in space and et cetera, et cetera. There's lots of the biological differences of microgravity are noteworthy. And at least some of the early business ideas involve a lot of biological science. But the point is, if you drop the cost of access, lots of entrepreneurs are going to think of lots of reasons to be there.
I'm really excited to see the film. Thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.